The big thing that was happening, you know, at, when the time, in the 60s, it was the MOS transistor.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, see, what happened in the field of integrated circuits was that, as you know, the first transistors by Bardeen and Bratton were these point contact transistors. Well, they never made it into. And then people started working on transistors that would be diffused junction and alloy junction transistors. And essentially bipolar transistors all through the 50s, and trying to understand how to make these transistors in production. But at the same time, there was a they had originally started out on a transistor to try to look for a field effect transistor, but they were not very successful, and as Bardeen explained it, the voltage that was applied created flux lines, but these flux lines terminated on these so-called surface states in the device, and these surface states were so large in number that the flux lines couldn't penetrate into the semiconductor and modulate the charge. So to create a device based upon the field effect principle was very difficult in the early days. But along near the end of the 50s, there was work being done at Bell Laboratories by Duan Kong and Natala. These were two people, and they published a paper in the 1959 at the Device Research Conference on some of their studies, and they had made an MOS transistor at the time. And Bell Laboratories, I think, had actually made these transistors, and one of the people working there on it was John Horney, who later went to Fairchild and worked with Noyce and the people out there to develop the first type of MOS transistor, which was in the early 60s that these came out. The same time, Jack Kilby was working down there in Texas Instruments to put together discrete elements and bond them together. And I can remember at the time that this was produced, there was a lot of laughing going on in our lab saying, hey, this is not an integrated circuit, because we were working on molecular electronics. Everything had to be unidentifiable. And the thought was, well, anybody can take these things and bond them together and get them to working. That's a lesson to people, you know. They shouldn't think that way. They should say, well, look, if it's so easy, why don't we try to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And so Jack had the foresight to put something like that together, made an oscillator, and was credited with co-inventing the integrated circuit, along with Bob Noyce. But and the bipolar transistor suffered from some major issues, and it still does, and that is the power dissipation issue in bipolar. And MOS came along, and we were able to compact, make delay lines, and do it with very low power. The other thing bipolar does is not a very good low-level switch or chopper. There's an inherent offset voltage in the bipolar transistor, whereas in an MOS transistor, if you have zero current, you have zero voltage across the terminals of the device, the output terminals. So the MOS transistor started taking over, but it was a P-channel device in the 60s. And the reason it was is that because people could work with N-type substrates and not be subjected to what we call inversion layers. These inversion layers came as a result of positive charge that was accumulating in the overlying oxide. And if you had an N-type semiconductor, positive charge in the oxide, all that would do is make the surface more N-type. And it was already N-type, so that wasn't a particular problem. Problem came is when you had a P-type semiconductor, you had positive charge, tracks electrons to the surface, you invert the surface. So you would form channels, and these channels would connect circuits all around the wafer, and it would just be a mess. So rather than deal with this, people wanted to design circuits initially with only P-channels, devices that were fabricated in N-type substrates. Well, after people learned how to control the surface, and things got a little bit better with the technology, N-channels came along. And circuits moved initially in the 70s with N-channel technology in MOS. But there was a sort of a watershed in the technology around the time, it was about the last part of the 70s, when you're trying to go from the 64K DRAM to the 256K. At that point, the power dissipation, if you used N-channel technology, was getting out of sight. It was up in the watts per chip. And the reason was the sense amplifiers, that, as I mentioned before, you need to sense the information that's stored. At a 256K level, the sense amplifiers were a large in number. The power dissipation was so high, the chips were heating up. And you had many companies just struggling to hold on to the technology. Intel, Motorola, all of these companies were using multiple clocking schemes. IBM was looking for flip chips, ways to cool things. But holding on to the N-channel technology. Here we are sitting back in the aerospace companies. We have the CMOS technology. It's low power. But our United States companies are not moving in that direction. But as I remember, Japanese companies like Toshiba started moving. They captured the world market in DRAMs. They captured it in logic. They were moving aggressively in CMOS to where they had, I believe, the Japanese were well over 60% at one time in the world market. The United States was being squeezed. Well, we got going again. We started, you know, getting our CMOS capability going. But you can see the transitions in the technology moves on the basis of power dissipation. Even to this day, if your fan goes out on your computer, you're in trouble, as you know. And so it's a major issue. Power is always going to play a role, especially in consumer laptop products. Mm-hmm.